Unreserved Immigrant is a podcast that explores life as an immigrant in a foreign country. We explore the role of culture, work, and family as it relates to identity. Our guests range from founders, home executives, medical professionals, construction workers, musicians, maids, corporate specialists, and so forth. Unreserved Immigrant is a Sniper Wolf production. In this episode, we speak to Masimba Sasa, who was born in Zimbabwe and is now living in South Africa, where he works as a photographer. We hope you enjoy this episode and remember that this is a two-part interview.
Hi guys, welcome to today's podcast. Thank you for joining me. I hope you enjoyed the previous podcast. Today we have a new and interesting guest. His name is Masimba Sasa. Masimba Sasa lives in South Africa and he is from Zimbabwe. Hello Masimba.
Hi Pumza, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing all right, thanks.
Okay, so Masimba, could you tell us a little bit about Masimba Sasa? Who is Masimba Sasa?
That's a very tricky question, but if you want a politically correct answer, I'm a Christ follower first, and then I'm a husband, and then I'm a father, and then I'm a photographer.
Okay. Masimba Sasa, you are from Zimbabwe. And you have been living in South Africa for how long now? I don't think you've counted in a long time.
No, I haven't. But thankfully, calculators do exist. So I'll be able to tell you that just now. I have been in South Africa for the last 15 years.
Okay, wow. So how old were you when you arrived in South Africa?
I was 22.
Okay, and 22. That was young and naive and wet behind the ears. What was Zimbabwe looking like at the time when you left?
Goodness, that's a very difficult question on many levels. I think so. Obviously, the country had gotten to a place where we were in sanctions.
Okay, wait. What year was this again? Was this 1999?
When Zim went into sanctions.
Yeah. When you were 22, I guess. But I think Zim did go into sanctions in 99 or 98.
Because I came to South Africa in 2005.
Yes, okay.
Zimbabwe had gone through a period of possibly having been in sanctions for the last 5 years, and we'd gone through different strains and challenges. You know, we had gone through petrol queues, our currency becoming deflated. I had the perfect answer for what our currency did, but that's obviously gone out the window. But also, in all of that confusion, and also in all of that hopelessness, there was also still quite a lot of hope.
I know you have siblings, and now I'm wondering, what did the family look like before you left? Whether maybe you were pushed by your parents or older siblings to leave the country? Was it a personal ambition to leave? What pushed you to leave?
So it's two things. I think the first was the fact that I got to a place where I discovered that I wanted to be a photographer. And in discovering that I wanted to be a photographer, you get to a point where you realize that if you're going to compete on a global scale or platform, you need to immerse yourself in an environment that will allow you to compete. So that was the first thing. Second thing was that as I began my career in photography, I was introduced to quite a number of prominent photographers who I only later realized were prominent. And they kept telling me about the school where they'd been, or rather the school that they'd studied at. And a lot of these photographers were actually coming to Zimbabwe when Zimbabwe was still part of cricket. So obviously Zimbabwe was still competing with other countries.
Yes.
And would meet at these cricket fields as well as assisting another local photographer whose bags and gear I'd carry. And would talk about what kind of hopes and possibilities lay in photography. And fast forward to a couple of months, I got an email from one of these photographers. And he mentioned that the school was opening up a program that hadn't been done and were looking for photographers on the continent.
Oh, wow. So you were one of the first. I didn't know this. Guys?
Yeah, I was.
I actually know Masimba personally. He's one of my really close friends. But I'm hearing a lot of this afresh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that you were one of the first to actually be part of the program.
And as these things go, I applied. I did a telephone interview. And I felt like I got every single question wrong. But I got an email the following week being told that I'd been accepted and that I was getting an 82% funded bursary.
Great achievement. Well done. So, yes, you got the scholarship and then you moved to South Africa. What did your parents say? What were your parents thinking, 22-year-old, going to carve out a life for himself alone for the very first time in South Africa? Did you even know anyone here? Who was here?
Chucks, there's so much to say within your question, so I'll probably feed you information that you haven't asked for, and I hope our guests won't mind.
No, I don't think they will.
So there's several things that were at play. I think the first thing was that I was coming to do photography.
Okay.
That in its own was a problem, and that would have been a problem on any given day. Because my father...
Even if you'd done it at UZ.
Absolutely, even if I'd done it there. My father, and I'd also even say my mother, had different hopes for me. So I wouldn't say reservations, or probably that too, but I think their hopes and desires for me were definitely not that of me getting into photography. And at the back of that, we had lost my older brother, who was working as a doctor in London in a car accident. So I think my father felt that he was using yet another son. And the reason being that then the UK, and at that time, and I'd like to believe that even up until now, the news that they said about South Africa and Africa, even though he's from the continent, isn't great at all. I remember having a conversation with him the night before I left, and he kept asking me, "Are you sure you're leaving?" And I had to keep saying, "Yes, I'm sure." And I think he ended off the conversation with saying, "Just please don't come back in a body bag. We've already lost one. We can't afford to lose another."
Yeah.
And I think at that time, the stats at the time were saying that I think Joburg and Brooklyn were at par in terms of crime.
Oh, my goodness.
Where it was coming from, yeah.
That is a terrible statistic. Isn't it so strange that parents, like, you are not in anyway anything but creative, but still somehow in that parents can see a doctor.
Yeah.
Parents in that can see IT specialist. Parents in that can see some, I don't know, construction engineer. So you came, you arrived in South Africa, and you started making a life for yourself. What was that like? What was it like to finally be the Zimbabwean in a relatively good country, to be young, 22, and in a world of, I won't say full of possibility, but I'll say more possibility. Because I also know that at that time there were a lot of people who were still left behind in Zim.
Correct, yeah.
What did that feel like?
That's a very difficult question to ask. I feel that some of those answers have only come to me now that I've been in the country long. And the reason I say this is that I got to South Africa and had an exceptionally sheltered life. I lived within a community of middle-class and relatively well-to-do foreigners.
Yeah, he lived in the northern suburbs, guys.
That in itself shaped my experiences, and the experiences that I had possibly of my first couple of years in the country are now different to, I guess, how I see the country now, how I see the relationships that are formed, and how I'm intentional about those relationships and how I want to lead my life. I mean, I was dropped off and picked up.
Yes, I remember that. That was shocking to me because I went to Joburg. Fine, yes, my parents took me. They dropped me off in varsity. But then I had to sort of fend for myself. Granted, they paid for my fees, but whatever else was short was on me. Getting from point A to point B was on me. Like, if I ran out of money, like, that's it. Sorry. And the thing is, they gave me they gave me less than I could live on. So
yeah.
I was definitely running out every month, and I had to take on part-time jobs and stuff. So it was very weird for me seeing this person who had people he could call to pick him up when he was out having a nice time.
I'm not so sure about nice time.
Well,
but
for me, yeah. It wasn't things that were crucial. Like, you didn't have to be here hanging out with us. So, like, I know in my, even if I was back home, like, it will take a lot for anyone to fetch me from having a nice time. Like, you find your own way home. No one sent you out. But okay.
This is true. But for your listeners who are probably gobsmacked, I just want to reassure them that that was also short-lived.
Yes, there was
a time when I was flung out into the world and I had to fend for myself. I had to figure out how to get back home on my own. I had to navigate taxis. I've got a very fond memory of negotiating taxis with a specific taxi driver who'd always stop for me along Jansmat.
Mm-hmm.
He recognized me and would always stop for me. And at the time, we couldn't understand each other, but he would point at me and give me instructions to sit in the front.
Okay.
And always point at the change that needed to be dispensed, and would point at the people. And all this happened without any
communication, like while talking.
Yeah, and that was helpful because I think you realize that, in as much as language is crucial, as humans, we find a way of navigating around that to survive.
Yeah, I'm actually thinking that I actually learned a lot of taxis from you. Like, I remember calling you to say, where do I get a taxi to town? Or when I'm on this, what was that street, Princess of Wales?
Yes, Princess of Wales.
Yeah, where would I catch a taxi to this place? So yes, yeah, my street cred, you helped my street cred. But you did come on late.
Yeah, to the party.
You onboarded late. When I think of it now, the person you were when I met you, that being the person who was being picked up versus the person who was now all on his own, those are two completely different people. You just became so fast, so street smart, so learning how to survive, how to adapt, and just how to be whatever you needed to be very, very quickly. Whereas before, there was those people like who are like, who have glazed eyes like in a cult. Before you were like everything is fine, you know, everything is okay. But as soon as like you had to live on your own, and you came alive. Okay, so you did this life, you lived this life in Joburg, and you became a professional photographer. How has that been like, especially considering that you are a professional photographer who's also a foreigner, a professional photographer who has his own business? Has it been easy trying to negotiate the space? Because I know it's almost like you're treated like you're a secondary citizen, second grade person, but your life is number one to you. So how have you survived, and how has that experience been?
My older brother always says something that's been quite profound and continues to help the way I frame how I live life. He says that people are your greatest resource. And I think I've used that even in business. So you'll find that the majority of work that I get is purely based on relationship.
Mm.
I've got no shadow of doubt that if I was to try and compete at a different level...
If you were trying to compete on nationality...
Yes, correct.
On race,
on language...
Yes.
I would fall short. And because I'm keenly aware of that, I literally use the relationships I've built to survive and to get work. Those relationships somehow then... They do several things. They give you credibility, but they also shield you.
Mm.
Because in sticky moments where people are trying to wonder why you're speaking the local language at the time, or when people suddenly discover with shock horror
that you're not one of them,
you always end up having had people who almost, it feels like they're spin doctors. They've done all the PR for you.
Yeah.
They've gone in and they've kind of explained what your name means, and they've kind of explained that, please, if he speaks to you in English, he's not being offended.
I remember doing that for you, actually.
Yeah.
Explaining you before you would come into a space.
Yeah.
I think I did that for all my foreign friends. I do that for my husband, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that helped immensely, knowing that you've got people who, A, believe in what you do, two, believe in your work, and then three, also understand your heart.
Yeah.
You know, because I think in business, you're never in a situation where smack dab, you're pitching for work or you're against other people, and no one's got time for that.
True.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've been doing this for X number of years. I'm a creative myself, but I think I have the advantage of
being in my own country. And I think mentally it's like a some kind of balm where, like, no matter how hard it gets, I sort of feel like, well, at least I'm home, you know. And home represents safety, it represents hope, it represents that when something changes, then I'll be able to be a part of this because it's home. Because photography, film, just art is so difficult, how do you keep hope alive as a foreigner, as a creative in 2020? Like yesterday, I ran into someone I studied with, and they are my age, 35. They've been working in film for the last, how many years now? Well, I'll say the person's been working in film from 18, because that's when we started working on our careers, even if it was first at a varsity level. And the person's now at the point where they're like, I quit our industry. This lockdown was my breaking point. I will be and go and do anything now. He just wants to start again. So where you have not said that, hey? You have not said that. I don't know the number of times I've said that to you. But not once have I heard you say, I think I'm going to go be a teacher or, I don't know, something else. Sorry, teachers. It's not that I think it's easy, but someone once told me you will always have a job as a teacher.
Look, I think for many it goes without saying that when you go to a new city or a new village or a new town, you're fully aware of where you're coming from. And there's a clear line of what needs to be done. So the first thing is that failure isn't an option. Beyond that, understanding...
You didn't come from Zimbabwe to fail.
No, not at all. Yeah. It's not possible. So it's understanding that... Firstly, failure isn't an option. And secondly, it's understanding that you've been placed in an environment that's better equipped and well-resourced than you were. And by default, that means that even on your worst day, you're still better than how you were equipped when you were back home.
Wow.
And so I've got to be quite clear about this. The context, obviously, is purely within my career as a photographer.
Yes, and very uniquely to you.
Correct. So you kind of say to yourself, okay, look, things aren't great, but however, I can go to a fast food outlet and sit and siphon off free Wi-Fi and not be asked if I'm buying anything. I can go to a library in the city and spend my whole day just looking at photography books.
Yes.
So you begin to appreciate the things that you firstly don't have access to, and also the things that your new home, because this is my home, you appreciate it for what it is and what it offers you, and that gives you hope. Because I think for every moment where you don't feel great, you're like, oh, but hang on, there are all these opportunities, and all these opportunities are what give you hope. Because you say to yourself, you can't be in despair. Why be in despair when you're in a city or a country filled with resources?
Yes.
You know, why be in despair when you're in a country that allows you to do things that you probably would never have been allowed to do at the time that you wanted to do them? And then with regards to being a foreigner, being here for so long, you know, one's built like very meaningful relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably I'll probably keep going back to relationships. And I think because for me, it's a huge value system in my life. And what that does for you is that you stop seeing yourself as someone different.
You stop seeing yourself as outside because you are inside.
No. You are inside. You're aware of the things that make you different, but those things that make you different are not the things that are hindering you from progressing.
Yeah.
And obviously there's a context to it. And I would imagine being in a city like Johannesburg that's so cosmopolitan, there was a time when it was actually cool to have friends who were different and who came from everywhere.
Yes.
So I guess we drank off that Kool-Aid for a very long time.
Mm. I mean, as part of your inner circle, if I may say that, just on what you've just said, I also realize that I don't interact with you as a foreigner. I don't interact with you as an outsider.
Yeah.
Because you're in my inner circle. I think maybe the feeling of being foreign might only come up when you're feeling unfamiliar with a group. Which is a common feeling, because it's not like I would feel like an outsider in any group that I'm not connected to, where I don't have relations with the members of that group. So you don't walk around feeling like a foreigner. You don't walk to the shops feeling, oh, I'm a foreigner. It's how you interact in relationships that makes you feel accepted or a part of or outside of, which I think we can all connect to or relate to as just human. I know that that now is a journey which maybe from around age 22 to 28. I watched you now develop from this young, excited man, boy, to a husband. What was it like now when you were now around, I think it was around age 28, 30 or 32, and you were in the process of looking for a wife? It's like the Bible. It's like you went somewhere to find a wife.
Yeah.
When you had to like pick a wife, gosh, it's like you're in a nice field. When you had to pick a wife, were you trying to make this wife that you were going to choose fit where you come from? Or did she have to match you? So did you think, oh, my tete, what would my tete think of this one? Or, you know, were you trying to make choices based on Zim pride, if I can put it that way, on trying to find someone who will work for when I have to go back home? Or were you just being a guy in love?
I was being a guy in love. I think
it sounds so cheesy.
The two things that were quite important to me, for me being a people's person, my biggest prayer is that whoever I ended up with would love people. They didn't have to love people to the extent that I did, but they had to love people in their own way.
Yeah.
And that was a very important thing for me. Eventually kind of summed up so many decisions that got to the point of getting to a life partner.
And were you already starting to get family pressure? Like, were they already starting to say, in South Africa, a wife? You know, like, were they wanting to sort of introduce you to the girls, maybe in Zim, and, you know, like, was there any family pressure yet?
Thankfully not, but I think having siblings who are older, I think my parents bear the battle scars of having had to negotiate with siblings who've either married out of their race or out of what one would consider out of their caste. I think my parents have had to contend with all of that. And I think when it came to me, I guess I would probably say that, for lack of a better word, they'd become toothless tigers.
Okay, we're lucky in that way.
Yeah, they were exhausted.
Yeah.
You know, the fight had already been fought and it had been won.
And who did you end up with? Did you end up with a local, or did you end up with someone from Zim? Just for the benefit of the audience.
So this is a bit of an inside joke. I mean, if you were to ask my wife, obviously the context being perhaps if you asked her quite earlier on, or if podcast had happened quite earlier on, I would say that I married an Australian. But however, my wife happens to be from Zimbabwe, but she's lived a substantial amount of her formative years and now currently in Australia. There. And that has shaped, I guess, a lot of her identity.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm breathing because I'm just thinking of the impact that the places we go to when we're 18 for university actually end up being the places that we feel define the people we are.
Yeah.
Like, I feel inside me that I'm a Joburger. I spent more time in the Eastern Cape because it was from birth to 18. But I feel like those choices weren't my choices. A lot of the things I thought were not because of the world I created. I was living in someone else's world, someone else's choices. But Joburg from 18 is what I feel like I chose the varsity I'd go to. I chose to go to AFTA. I chose what I'd study. I chose my apartment. Like, hey, Dad, this is what I want. I chose my friends, you know. So I get it that she is Australian in a way, though born in Zimbabwe. And you say she's living in Australia now. Is that as a result of, could you explain that for our viewers?
And I think there's an interesting challenge that happens to migrants who meet each other and they both happen to be living in different countries. At the time when we decided to be serious about each other, we both had been respectively living in the two countries for 10 and a half years.
Wait, sorry. How did you actually know her again? Like, because I'm like, I don't know how he knew.
All right, yes. So two mutual friends of ours were getting married, and we met at the engagement party here in Joburg. So she came down or up, depending on how you define that, to the engagement party.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought you guys just met online. No, I'm being silly.
No, we didn't, but I think the relationship kind of then got forged online.
Yes.
This was during the time when if someone gave you their Skype ID, it was actually a big deal.
It was a big deal. You were in. You were in, right? It's like a response on the DM.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the first part of this interview. If you enjoyed this podcast, remember to subscribe and share. If you would like Sniper Wolf Media to tell your story, or perhaps you'd like to donate or partner with us, please send an email to janice@sniperwolfmedia.co.za. We would love to tell your story.